Welcome to the Emotional Horsemanship Podcast. I am your host, Lockie Phillips, and I help deeply caring equestrians create emotionally balanced horses with science, empathy, and feel. This podcast is a safe place for anyone who desires a better future for horses and for the equestrian lifestyle. I hope that you will enjoy these solo and collaborative episodes where we enjoy a deep insight into our horses' worlds and ways in which we can make that better for them. If you love horses and are willing to do right by them, you're going to love this podcast. And I thank you for being here. Bex Nan is a classical dressage, breeding, and dissection professional located in New Zealand. Bex says that she started her journey towards dissecting horses because it was a missing piece of her education, and she was seeking answers as to why some horses just can't be helped. Her journey towards classical dressage and why she now has the approach of less is more has been informed by her experiences in dissecting horses and traveling New Zealand giving dissection clinics. Bex joined me for a really open, powerful, and honest conversation into some of the problems we're now starting to face in horse breeding and in performance horses. And I was so grateful to have this opportunity to speak with her on the podcast about something that is really, really important to me too. Hello, Bex. How are you? Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, good, good. It's 10 o'clock in the evening here, so I'm winding down from a busy day.
So you're in New Zealand, right?
Yes, yep.
Yes, as we can hear from your accent, I'm Australian, so we have our Anzac connection here.
Oh, you're Australian. I didn't realize that because you're based in the States, Canada.
No. I'm in Spain.
Oh, wow.
I live in Spain. I live in Europe, but I was born in Melbourne.
Oh, right. Oh, that's amazing. Okay, so we're kind of neighbors.
Yeah. We're kind of neighbors. I mean, at least we were.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I spent a lot of time in Australia.
So I'm really excited to have you here. And I invited you after you, I've been following you for a while and seeing what you put out there and really respecting it. And then this week you made a post that really moved me on a subject that's really close to my heart. And I was like, okay, I need to have you in a conversation. I'd love to get something on the record with you to spread this message and to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So we're going to get to that today. But before we do, mm-hmm. how would you describe to people the following? Who you are, what you do, and how you do it?
Oh, okay. What I do.
It's a big question, but we're starting with a big question.
Okay, so there's three parts there. What I do. Okay, so what I do now, what fills my weeks, it's 7 days a week, is dissecting horses and processing the bones and then recording what I'm finding, photography and videography of the findings. I'm still obviously feeling my way through all of this. I'm in my fourth year now. I'm up to my 46th horse. The sort of milestones that you want to meet, but you know, you also understand what's been required to meet these milestones of, you know, how many horses I've looked at. So it's sort of
46 horses on your own.
What's that? Sorry?
46 horses you have dissected on your own, is that right?
Yeah, some of those have been with other people. So when I first started doing this, I quietly just started bringing home skeletons. So how I started.
Okay, whoa, hold the phone. You don't just get to say, that's a dramatic understatement, which is very of the antipodes for you. So tell me, how does someone just quietly bring home a horse skeleton, Bex?
Oh, look, I know, this is all quite normal to me, but I suppose to people listening to this, they'll be like, what? And have a response like you just did. Okay, so you have to sort of backpedal because how this came.
Yeah, let's backpedal.
Yeah, let's backpedal. Okay, so how this came about is obviously being a trained taxidermist, working with dead things for me is quite normal. I've been doing that since I was 16. So it's quite normal for me to be working with a deceased animal. However, what happened 5 years ago is I had always been rehoming off the track racehorses, mainly in my later years, standardbreds, but I did start out on thoroughbreds and just gravitated towards the standardbred because I really love their nature. And 5 years ago, I started a charity with a group of people on the board of trustees called Stable to Stirrup. And when that all got underway, after our first year, we noticed that 30 to 40% of the horses weren't finishing the program. They were having mental or physical issues. And it was a big thing in the charity that we practice what we called ethical rehoming. So ethical rehoming means that we don't believe in rehoming paddock mates because they don't have a great outcome. Our welfare organisations here that, you know, aren't a full-on rehoming program, they are full to the brim of unusable thoroughbred standardbreds that are just sitting in paddocks doing nothing. And I don't believe that that's a life for a horse either. So ethical rehoming to us was, if the horses aren't suitable to be rehomed and they're not going to have a useful life for, you know, the average rider, then we believe in humane euthanasia. Market here with horses is absolutely flooded and there just aren't great outcomes. And it only takes for you to see horses come back in terrible condition with their feet not done, full of worms, miserable. And I just believe that there is a fate worse than death and that horses don't, they don't go through life going like, I wonder how I'll die. And I wonder if there's a heaven. And, you know, like they don't have that thought process. They're alive and one day they're not. And so they live in the moment, which is the wonderful thing about horses. But so I pushed really hard at the beginning that we would put the horses down. So after the first year, 30 to 40% is the rate and we put the horses down. And the second year, I became more perplexed about why these young horses of, you know, 3, 4, 5, very young, not even reached maturity yet, were having so many problems. And so the our local, we call them dog tucker men, I'm not sure, internationally.
Christ alive.
What the?
Yeah.
Because
The knackers. You're
right,
really
okay,
at the coal face.
Yeah, you've got it.
You're
awful.
At the coal face of the breeding industry there. I mean, that's really the pointy end of the stick.
It is.
Before we go further, I just want to say this, because I deal with a lot of very sensitive, very caring horse people.
Yeah.
And the decision and the leadership that you have to understand where you are in New Zealand, the industry is flooded,
yeah.
There's not enough safe places for a retired paddock horse, and that the most humane and kindest alternative is to end that horse's life. That is the pointy end of the stick that I'm not sure I would have the stomach to take responsibility for, but you've stepped up to the plate and you're making those decisions and you've probably saved a lot of horses from a fate worse than death. So you have my bravo for that.
Yeah, look, it's not easy. When I first started doing this when I was 18, you know, I used to hear of people putting horses down for what I thought at the time was no good reason, and it mortified me. It's not, you know, I didn't start doing this thinking like, yeah, I'm going to put, you know, 30% of the horses that I work with down. You know, it's awful. But you have to, you know, people need to remember I've been doing this for 20 years. And so you see these horses through the entirety of the relationship with the human, the breakdown of the relationship, you know, the horse becomes unusable anymore and then its options are very limited. You know, I've seen all that play out. And you know, one thing, because the charity was set up in such a structured way and we had so many jobs for specific people, you unfortunately get to see that whole journey play out in front of you in a very structured way. And so what I firmly believe is that it's not only not fair on the horses, it's not fair on the people, because I think there's such an emphasis on, you know, you're doing it wrong, you're doing this. And yes, that is a big part of it. Obviously, like horsemanship, you know, is everybody should learn, you know, good horsemanship. And quite often it's not the horse's fault and it's a lack of understanding. But when it comes to X-ray horses that might be harbouring, you know, ulcers, early onset arthritis, you know, all the variations that I find throughout the horse's body, they're just physically struggling. And then there's a mental struggle for the horse too, because, you know, it's not nice for a horse and a rider to be, you know, butting heads and just not getting along, and they both get frustrated, they both get confused. And so that's an unfair situation for both parties to be in. And so, yeah, so anyway, I went to the board and I said, look, I actually had the skills to start looking inside of these horses. Would you mind if I actually you know, once the horses were processed at the knackery, if I brought home, you know, big wool sacks full of horse, essentially, because it's very daunting to jump straight into doing full horse dissection. There's just, I mean, we're talking about 500 kgs of flesh and bone and all the intestines. It is a lot to undertake. So I started doing it, you know, just from a skeletal point of view and slowly taking apart all the joints. And I would see, you know, uneven wearing of cartilage, particularly in cervical spine in horses, standardbreds. And I would see it in the same place, base of the neck. Half of the cartilage was worn down from that high fixed position. So the APJ joints are in the horse's neck in the cervical spine, and when they've been in one fixed position, they tend to start wearing down the cartilage unevenly. So that was the first thing that I noticed. And then I'd been doing it for maybe almost 2 years, and I started branching out and talking to vets and other dissectionists. And the first thing that really hit me was I was talking to quite a well-known vet who does dissections, and I said, we were talking about pelvises, and I said, all my tubosacrals are like touching or under 1 centimeter apart. And she was like, what? And I said, yeah, I just thought that was quite normal. You know, it's not what it looked like in the anatomy books that I've got, but that's what I'd see. And she was like, oh, okay, well, I only dissect really, you know, older sport horse types. And she said all of my tubosacrals would be 3 to 4 centimeters apart, sometimes bigger in heavier breeds or quarter horses.
So just describe this piece of the anatomy for someone who doesn't understand the Latin words. So describe it in layman's terms for someone.
Okay, so when you look at your horse's hind end, if you've ever seen a horse, and it's particularly in thoroughbreds, they have a triangular rump. So you'll often see the muscle is wasted away. The tubosacrals sit up at the top of the pelvis like this. And the reason they're really important, and the reason they mean to have a...
Like the stegosaurus bit, you know, like the top of the bone along the back of the pelvis.
Yes, or you're good at explaining this stuff. Top of the pelvis, up off the ilium, and then when you see like a thoroughbred that's got a compromised hind end, it's often called a hunter's bump. What you're seeing there is the top of the two bones, and that normally happens because of a pelvic rotation and can be because of subluxation of the sacrum and the lumbar. So that's really, really common. I see that a lot. And then I started seeing all these variations in the lumbar and the pelvis that I thought were normal when I was just looking at racehorses. Particularly in the lumbar, I'll see the transverse processes all scrunched up. And of course, I was only looking at racehorses. And by this point, I'd looked at, so, you know, normal to me because that's all I'd seen. And that was all I had access to. So my first 12 horses, bar one thoroughbred and one warm blood that I had a Swedish warm blood that had ECBM. He was actually one of the first ones that I dissected. But mainly I was looking at the standardbreds. And so then I started looking at sport horses, and all of a sudden the differences between, you know, I've got quite a few unridden horses in my collection now, and the stark differences between the wear and tear that I was seeing in the race horses compared to the sport horses. And some of the sport horses that I was dissecting, you know, were over 20, and they weren't even showing as much damage as some of the young race horses that I was looking at. So I suppose...
I'm sitting here in the perspective of someone who has no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So I know what you're talking about, but I'm thinking about the people who don't know, because that's who I'm trying to speak to. Mm-hmm. So what you are saying is that you had a selection bias. You were working with mainly racehorses, standardbreds and thoroughbreds, so trotters and gallopers.
Yeah.
And you were seeing these bodies, you were holding the bones in your hands and thinking they were normal. Yeah. And then when you spoke to some of your colleagues who are doing similar work with different breeds, you discovered that the bones in your hands were not normal.
No.
Not normal. So you were dealing with bony malformations plus damage on top from use of the bodies. So the bodies were born a certain kind of way and then they were used a certain kind of way, and there's two different types of issues that you're dealing with here. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct. So one of the worst things that horses have got going for them is that soft tissue damage, so anything to ligament, tendon, muscle, Well, muscle's a little bit faster, but ligament and tendon particularly, you're on a 6 to 9 month schedule to heal, right? But bone can start changing and ossifying in 8 weeks' time. So think about when you...
Shit, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so when I explain that to people, that's why I see so much osseous change. So think if you fracture your arm, and it's just a normal fracture, you know, in 8 weeks' time, 8 to 12 weeks' time, that cast can come off and the bone has re-knitted and healed itself. So that's how quickly bone can react. And I know there's been a lot of studies put out, you know, about how bones will remodel to the workload that they're under. And that is true. However, there hasn't been enough study into the rest of the horse's body, you know, because those studies are done on distal limbs. And so it's just
lower legs.
It's lower legs. Yeah, sorry. I'll try and talk in lay terms.
My job is going to be to translate you to the layperson.
I like that.
So you just be yourself.
You spend a lot of time when you learn doing this. You know, when I first looked at all the bones and stuff, my language was very, very layperson. And then as you go through your journey and you have to learn all the Latin names and
you just stick with it. That's normal.
It's really hard because you want to stay relatable to the lay people. So one of the things that I am really passionate about is not making this too sciencey, because I'm not a vet. I'm not a scientist. I come at this from a completely different angle. And I mainly started looking at the inside of horses because I was so frustrated by the limitations of, you know, retraining them, and I very quickly learned that you know, even vets will tell you that they're frustrated by their own limitations of diagnostic equipment, and so that's been a really interesting journey for me. You know, some of the horses that I dissect come with a long vet history, and then you correlate what is in the history you know, to what you're finding in the horse's bodies, and they often don't match, or there's more damage in an area that's had like a compensation problem, and that's actually been the red herring that the vets have picked up on. So I think we're really in early days with diagnostic equipment for horses particularly, and it is getting better, but massively expensive. Just not available.
Massively expensive.
Yeah.
And so you were getting really, really frustrated in your nonprofit work trying to help horses out of the racing, both trotting and galloping system. And you said that you had a 30 to 40% euthanasia rate from these horses because of behavioral problems and potential diagnoses as well. Is that right?
Yeah.
And so you started processing these poor animals' bodies. So once you started processing these animals' bodies, what did you begin to find under the surface?
So the biggest thing is joint degeneration. So breaking down of the cartilage within the joint. Most race horses, I will find some kind of breakdown in the cartilage, particularly normally in the fetlocks. And normally what's accompanied with that is something called synovitis, which is an inflammatory response within the capsule.
The synovial fluid.
Exactly, synovial fluid. And it's really beautiful to look at. It looks like when you open up the joint and it's floating in the synovial fluid, it looks like little feathers. But it is meant to be incredibly uncomfortable. And it's something that I really haven't heard much about from vets. You can ultrasound for it. And generally speaking, the procedure would be to clean out the synovitis in the joint itself. Now, sometimes I'll see old synovitis that looks more yellowy, sort of whitened off where it's not active. And sometimes I'll open up the joint and it's just full of red inflamed tissue. So that was the biggest thing that I sort of saw. And I spoke to about 4 vets about it. A couple scratched their head and 2 of them said, yep, definitely synovitis is inflammatory. But I was surprised at how often I was seeing it and how little information there was about how prolific it was in the horses that I was looking at online. And that's something that has happened quite often. It's like, for example, I'll often see when there's damage to the pelvis that there'll be damage to both femoral heads. So top of the thigh bone, if you will, going into the pelvis, sort of a ball and socket joint. And, you know, something that's really common in humans is a hip replacement. They get osteonecrosis in the femoral head, and they chop it off and they replace it. And that is something that I see really, really often in the racehorses that have a compromised pelvis. Is like you open up the joint capsule and there's this huge bruise on top of the femoral head and it's been worn down to bone. And what I started doing was actually chopping the area in half, so sawing the bone in half, and there's just this huge deep bruise that goes right through. And when the bones dry out, the bone matrix inside of the femoral head has actually been crushed. So there's all sorts of...
And how old are these horses? Oh, how old are they?
The youngest one's been 3.
Okay. All right. Okay. So when I started my work as an instructor, it was... I was reticent to step into the teacher and quote-unquote leader role because I just really loved horses and wanted to have it as like a private thing for myself. But I was standing around in these various environments watching these potentially egregious practices, horses under huge amounts of pressure, horses being forced to comply, horses being pushed. And no one was getting nowhere with some of these horses. And I've got some specific memories in mind. But I would step in and the genesis of my work was to say, time out.
Yeah.
Everybody stop.
Yeah.
What you're doing.
Yeah.
Think about what you're doing. Stop the craziness.
Mm-hmm.
A 3-year-old horse with a crushed hip joint.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell was happening to this animal that they were used to the point that their hip, the bone of the hips crush?
I know.
What is going on? Mm-hmm. Bex, tell me. Before I tear my hair out, what is going on?
Well, we're using horses' bodies before they've reached maturity.
Say that again for the people in the back.
We're spending horses' bodies before they have reached maturity. It's just...
And what is maturity age? What is maturity age in your perspective?
Six to eight. And when I say that, I mean 8 is at the higher side of maturity. But people don't realize that there's ossification processes that are going on right into the mid to late teens. You know, like suture lines and skulls don't start closing until, you know, 14, 15 years old. And that process continues throughout the entirety of the horse's life. So, you know, the big thing for me is the pubic symphysis and the pelvis. Your horse's pelvis is in 2 halves until it turns 6 years old. Now, 2 weeks ago, I dissected a 5-year-old standard bred. And I get down to the pelvis, and one of my favorite things to show to people, just because I have found that you have to horrify people to shock them into going, oh, wow, I should be paying attention to this.
Right.
So I take the pelvis out of an under 6-year-old horse. This horse was just over 5, and I break apart the pelvis, okay, along the pubic symphysis, because it is not fused yet. You just go, pull, and the pelvis breaks in 2. So that's a 5-year-old.
So you, a human woman, and you're not a bodybuilder.
No, I'm not.
You're not a bodybuilder.
Just an average woman.
You've been able to, with your regular arms, and most horse people have a more than average grip strength, especially if they're riding on contact, but that's another conversation. With your regular upper body strength, you can take a 5-year-old horse's pelvis and pretty easily break it in 2. That is correct?
Correct. So people don't realize, but a foal's pelvis actually starts out in 4 parts. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. So it starts out in 4 parts. I've got a really great video on my Patreon looking at a foal's pelvis, and it's amazing. It's a wonder to behold. So 4 parts, right? The acetabulum starts out, which is your hip joint, the hip cup.
Ball and socket.
Yep. Ball and socket. So we're looking at the socket part. That starts out as a complete cartilaginous joint with a joint through the middle of it. So your pelvis starts out in 4 parts. Now around
like Lego.
Yes, like Lego, exactly the same. And so about 14 to 16 months old, that turns into 2 sides, 2 halves. And then at 5 to 6 years old, that starts to fuse. And where the bones, you get something called osteophytes. And they knit together like this, and then they come one piece of bone. All right?
It's sort of like taking two pieces of plastic, melting the ends, and then joining them together and allowing them to dry. They sort of permanently fuse, or like welding metal together.
Welding,
that's how the bones
form. Metal.
So the bone might look like one whole piece, but there's little cracks in the bone which actually separate the parts and pieces.
Yeah.
And as you age, these parts and pieces knit together and form one consolidated whole, right?
Yes, correct. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
So what can happen is the reason that the pelvis is in danger is because where the two femoral heads attach into, through locomotion and movement, they push inwards like this. Okay. So the pelvis becomes the shock absorber for the movement. Okay. So the pelvis starts doing this because this part here, the pubic symphysis, it isn't fused. Okay. So it starts moving like this. Now you've got the sacrum that sits in between the pelvis. And that is held in there by cartilage connections and ligaments, okay?
Soft tissues only.
Soft tissues only. And so people think of that as being very, very strong. But in a young horse, all of those tissues are very, very malleable, okay? So the pelvis starts to rock in like this. You get little micro tears along the ligament, and all of a sudden the pelvis has fallen in on itself. Now, there's many problems with that. But basically, all of the angles become abnormal, and then you get extreme compensation patterns in the hind end of the horse. And the problem with the sprung pelvis is that once the pelvis is compromised, it can never go out again because there's no outward pressure. There's only inwards pressure. And so when I started, you know, doing full dissections and seeing all of these connections, and when I started dissecting foals and just seeing how loose and fragile all of this is, it blows my mind that people haven't sort of put two and two together. Like, why are horses breaking down so early? And yet a lot of the studies are geared around promoting that early work for bone. And it's really difficult to find a balance between all of the information that's around. But a lot of the information that I'm seeing just doesn't match up with what I'm seeing in the horses' bodies. And so,
well, we have to think about who is financing the studies that point to weight-bearing exercise and heavy exercise on young horses being of a benefit for their bony structures. Who is financing those? Is it the racehorsing lobby? I don't know. I'm just asking questions.
Yeah.
You know, this is my perspective, right? I'm often at the pointy end of the stick of this as well. You are at the coalface in a different way, but I'm at the coalface as well because with emotional horsemanship, I often get people who present to me what they describe as emotional horses.
Yeah.
9 times out of 10, an emotional horse has an underlying diagnosis.
Yes.
9 times out of 10 in my experience.
Yeah.
I've got very specific stories, horses that became hugely aggressive. They called me as a trainer, and what the horse actually had was a bloodborne virus. They needed penicillin, not a trainer.
Yeah.
It was a bloodborne virus that inflamed the anger circuits of the brain.
Yeah.
Or a horse that was incredibly aggressive and actually had PSSM2, now called MIM.
Yeah.
Or horses who were becoming difficult to ride forwards. They were getting sticky and they actually had ECVM, like their lower neck was just a mess. So, and the list goes on and on and on. Now, I can help that horse at an emotional, behavioral, and mental level to overcome the traumas associated with this. But 9 times out of 10 in my experience, these horses have a diagnosis. And just last week, I had a client come to me in North America with an off-the-track thoroughbred. They presented video to me and said, you know, it's really weird. She's pinning her ears and swishing her tail when I ride her. And I watched this video and I saw a mare try her heart out to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, this is discomfort. And I spent, instead of an hour talking about training, I spent an hour trying to talk to them about these diagnoses. And her face was just crestfallen.
Yeah.
Because you watched this entire fantasy that the owner has built in their head about rescuing the thoroughbred and having their equestrian fantasies and their dreams and their riding aspirations. You can watch all of that slowly crumble, and now they've become the manager of a major health problem. And that takes a very specific kind of owner. Not everyone is able to take that kind of very, very selfless path with their horse to provide safe spaces. And, you know, that's what I'm trying to encourage is more owners. I'm trying to intervene to create more safe places for some of these horses so that you don't have to put to sleep so many.
Yeah.
It's really, really terrifying. Now, I want to get a little bit more into bony malformations if we can. I'm really good. I'm good friends with Pam and Diane at the Bone Room in South Carolina.
Yeah.
So when I was in South Carolina last year, I went to the Bone Room. I met with them. They came and watched my clinic. They invited me to a tour. They have 50 specimens. And over the course of 2 hours, they changed my direction as a coach, as a trainer, and I was self-encouraged by them to set very, very clear and hard lines for the horses within my program as relates to diagnostics and their health. And it consolidated that the softly, softly approach with horses is the way for me, because you have got to create space for horses to say no and absolutely not, because my body is broken and I am in pain.
Yeah.
And we've got to run, not walk. Run towards teaching owners about conflict behaviors and signs of pain. We have to be teaching this. So talk to me, if you can, a little bit about genetic bony malformations. We've discussed about use-related bony malformations, you know, overuse injuries. But what about the genetic component, which is the equally terrifying part?
Yeah, look, it is terrifying. I think that breeding has been largely unregulated and unthought. It hasn't been a thoughtful process for a long time now, is kind of how I feel about it. One thing that really surprised me was looking at the anatomy books and then getting in their hands on and going, well, this doesn't look like the anatomy books. And so I see that by way of transitional ribs, where the 18th rib is trying to act like a transverse processor in the lumbar.
So it's like the last rib of the horse confused itself genetically and starts to behave in ways it shouldn't.
Yeah, correct. So,
and grow in ways it shouldn't.
Yeah, so where the problem stems from is that Arabs have 5 lumbar vertebrae and, or is it 6? God, am I getting confused now? I'd have to check my text on that one. But basically, no, it is 5. The Arab breed started with 5. Now, somewhere along there, when we started crossbreeding horses, we ended up with horses with 6 lumbar vertebrae. And because a lot of our horses have Arab breeding in them, it seems that the last rib and the first transverse processor, they get confused. And I've got specimens in my collection where there's a rib on one side and there's a transverse processor on the other side. And the problem with these last ribs is that they don't have a cartilaginous connection to the rest of the ribs, and they often bend backwards and stab the horse in the soft tissues in the flank. So,
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so that's one of the variations that I've seen a lot. And then what's another one? Obviously ECVM, which they are still working out the genetic component to that. And it's very complicated. And ECVM is a massive issue. I've got 4 horses in my collection and I've dissected an extra one with ECVM. So
let's explain ECVM, because this is the tidal wave that's coming for particularly the sport horse community from a genetic standpoint. This is really building on the horizon, and you are one of the first researchers and dissectors amongst a few number. Like I can count on less than 2 hands the researchers who are dissecting and researching this.
And look,
so what is it?
It wouldn't be even possible for me to talk about this without, you know, people like Sharon May Davis, you know, having pioneered
this.
Yeah, and doing all the research, because that's something that I'm not capable of doing. I'm not a scientist. I don't feel that that's my role. I feel that my role is more to educate lay people in kind of entertaining way on Facebook, because I want people to be interested in what's inside the horse's bodies. So I try and keep it very...
And you're succeeding with that. You're succeeding with that. I need to reach out to Sharon May Davis and get her on the pod. But ECVM, what does it stand for?
Equine Complex Vertebral Malformation.
More from Bex and Ann in a moment, but we're just going to take a break and a breather. So one of the biggest problems myself and my colleagues often come across is a lack of education amongst horse owners, riders, and even trainers. But that's not surprising, because often access to education is gatekept by exorbitant costs. People charging 4 and 5 figures for Zoom programs, 4 and 5 figures for pre-recorded content. I understand if a professional has a certain value, and I understand if it is necessary to gatekeep private services by such costs, especially if those private services involve flying somewhere or clearing your entire schedule to accommodate someone. But if we are to make the world a better place for horses, it is so important that we also create affordable and accessible options for horse people to educate themselves. That's why the Emotional Horsemanship Video Library is so important to me. It is so important to me that I can continue to create accessible options that are both affordable for me to deliver and affordable for you to integrate with. Though a clinic or a retreat with me might be more expensive, you can certainly learn about emotional horsemanship on a video library for less than a cost of a lunch. You can step in per month, or you can sign up for an entire year with a built-in discount. The Emotional Horsemanship Video Library has a wide range of information there for you to digest and work through. And if you really enjoy self-study and you're on a budget, this is absolutely the perfect option for you to begin working with me. So in a late stage capitalist hellscape where everything's become too expensive, including access to knowledge, I am proud to present to you that I will always keep accessible options on the table for those of you who need it, because that's what I needed as well 10 years ago. So I invite you to come and join me on the Emotional Horsemanship Video Library by going to emotionalhorsemanship.com and following the prompts. Now, let's return to our conversation with equine dissectionist and classical dressage breeder, Bex Nan in New Zealand. What does it stand for?
Equine complex vertebral malformation.
What does that mean?
It's a mouthful. So basically, it's a problem at the base of the neck of the horse. So C6 is right at the bottom of the horse's neck, and it's a very important vertebrae because it connects soft tissue onto the sternum, the first rib, and the thoracic spine. And there's many variations of it that I've seen. Sometimes it can be both tubercles, bilateral, sometimes it can be one tubercle, and then you can also have them transposed onto C7 where there's not meant to be any tubercles. I see problems in the longus coli muscle, which is basically an important muscle group that sits either side of the cervical spine. Sometimes you can have one hypertrophied or atrophied, so it just really depends. But I dissected one down in Dunedin, and she had this tiny, tiny little muscle on one side and a huge muscle on the other side. She was very, very one-sided to ride, and she used to trip regularly in her fronts as well. Something that I've seen twice now is compromised nerves in the neck. So you've got the brachial plexus nerve bundle that's in the area. And something that I saw just the other day with the thoroughbred that I dissected, I couldn't find the nerves on one side. Like normally you can, there's a huge branch of them that, you know, come out, and I couldn't find anything. And that was I seen you the video of her sort of bumping at the knees. And the disappointing part about that, Mia, is that she was seen by a very well-known veterinary surgeon here because her owner said she's got something wrong with her knees. She buckles over at the knees. And the owner thought it was in the knees. But oftentimes when they struggle with locomotion and their own biomechanics, it's because there's a compromise in the front end. And she was missing both first ribs, no attachment to C7. So,
and she was born this way.
Yeah,
and she
this was born this way. This is born this way. Yeah. So that's why ECVM is such a big problem, because you want to try and breed it out of the genetic, you know, the genetic pool, if you will. And I know a few other, who told me the other day there was a problem in Appaloosas that they managed to breed out. What did she say? I can't quite recall now, but there was a problem. There was a genetic problem. They tested for it, found the genetic mutation.
Marker.
But yeah, or marker.
Yep.
And they've managed to pretty much breed it out of the breed now. So I think that's really important moving forward that we have these genetic tests so that we're at least, you can at least make an informed decision. And then the hard part about ECVM is that there are horses competing at World Cup level in show jumping and Grand Prix dressage because of the very hand-dominated riding that we see these days in modern sport. If you hold the horse's neck up with your hands and you've got a bilateral malformation, you can get away with it. It's much harder if it's a one-sided malformation because these horses tend to be very, very one-sided. But when they're missing both turbicles on C6, they're just really super loose in the neck and they sort of rotate the shoulders. It's bizarre. Everything just looks sloppy in the front. And if you're a very hand-dominated rider, you can get away with riding those horses.
Wow. Okay. And I'm gonna reach out to Dr. Sharon May Davis and Pam and Diane.
Yes,
I want them to speak. And I'm also going to reach out to my colleagues, Helen and Elaine in North Carolina, who are at the coalface again with competitive horses who often have had this diagnosis. And I'm also going to be talking with Celeste Lazarus because she's at the biomechanical edge of the front end of horses. And I'm going to be really trying to spread this message because, as I understand it, early indications, this is not confirmed yet,
yep,
but early indications is that somewhere between 40 to 60% of thoroughbreds and possibly also warm bloods have a version of ECVM. That's 40 to 60, 40,
yeah,
to 60% of these horses have been born with bones that are not formed properly. They don't have attachment points. They are missing whole nerves. They're missing blood vessels. They're missing stability in this region. And yet the base of the neck, if we look at classical riding and correct preparation from an equitation perspective, mm-hmm, the base of the neck is a crucial component for horses who are ridden because this is where they get their stability from. And we're building riding horses whose bodies in their crucial components are basically liquid.
Yeah.
Quicksand. Yeah. Building a house in quicksand and wondering why the house has got problems.
Yeah.
You know? And so many of these horses have behavioral issues, but even more terrifyingly, some of these horses don't. I mean, what I loved about the bone room was that each of their bones didn't have a number on them, but a name. And
yeah,
you could they had dossiers on each of these horses.
Yeah.
And one of the dossiers said something like, was a very good boy, never aggressive, always compliant, always cooperative, and yet had these catastrophic injuries, was green-lighted by a vet, escalated the pressure in the training, another catastrophic injury, no diagnostics found, green-lighted by a vet again, and things just got worse and worse and worse. And it was only upon composting of the bodies that they discovered these diagnoses. And that's the terrifying part, is the diagnostics component that you mentioned earlier in our conversation, is that we are so limited in diagnostics. And some of these problems, both use issues and injuries and congenital malformations, genetic malformations, cannot be diagnosed in a living horse.
No. So two things that have really hit home for me doing the dissection work is, one is all behavior from a horse is genuine.
Love it. Say that again for the cheap seats in the back. Say that again.
All behavior from a horse is genuine. It's a genuine, you know, attempt to communicate with us. And the second thing is if you are not paying attention to the subtleties, your horse is going to start screaming at you. And
yes,
that's because of the way that horses are wired, they are compliant. They want to do the right thing. They don't want to be reprimanded, you know? And I often see horses that are just, that by the time they come to me, they're already at the screaming stage. And,
right,
you know, the people that own them, they're not bad people. It's just that we have to rewrite the way that people are approaching horses. And so, you know, I take my hat off to you still being able to do the training stuff, because I couldn't do it any longer. I just saw so many great horses with people who just weren't switched on to the emotional needs. They've got barely any empathy for the horse, and it's not their fault. It's because a lot of us, particularly in New Zealand, we came up through a system where it was like, pull harder, kick harder, whip harder, put a harder bit on. And so you know, you're not really treating the root cause of the problem. You're just slapping something more severe onto the horse. And what does that say to the horse? It says, I don't care about how you feel. And so this is the biggest problem that I saw in the racehorses, is that they had real trouble communicating to us their true level of discomfort. So I knew that if they were coming to me and they were showing aggression, or they were kicking out, or they were rearing or bucking or whatever it was, that horse was already, had already gone too far.
Too far gone.
Mm. And okay, if you're a very, very good rider, there are a lot of things you can help. You know, even if there's been bony changes, you can still help the horse to move in a better way, you know, depending on what the problem is. You know, that's not a blanket rule for every horse, but you can help to a certain extent. However, you know, ulcers is a big problem that I find in horses, and the ulcers become cyclic, because if there is an underlying issue in the bones or the structure or whatever, or there's a pain-related issue, they become cyclic and they just keep going. And I mean, I don't think that keeping a horse on low dose omeprazole for the rest of its life is really a solid management strategy.
No.
So,
no.
Yeah, huge ethical questions. And what I learned really early on with the dissection work and the bones, because I've got a large collection, I'm actually on Thursday heading off to our up in North Island to do a dissection, and I take my bones around and do bone clinics. Because being able to handle the bones and see them first, you know, firsthand.
The bones don't lie.
They don't lie. And I don't really have to say too much, because what I love about it is that it opens a conversation and people have their own epiphanies. You know, much like when you went to Pamela's bone room, like it's just you, the bones do the talking for you. And people have the same reaction when they see when we do the dissection and you take off the skin around the face, and they see how close those nerves are right under the skin. Massive nerve branches coming down the face, you know. And one lady was like, do you think a grackle noseband would be uncomfortable for a horse? And I was like,
oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Yes, maybe.
I was like, yeah, good. I think so. Because,
thanks for having that thought.
Yeah. You know, and she had ridden in a grackle her whole life and never questioned it. And we looked at the mouth and the different anatomy and stuff, and she was like, oh, I ride my horses, I have one bit for every horse. And I was like, oh. Okay. You know,
good.
People are having their own epiphanies at the dissections, and it's changed things from I felt like I was beating my head against a brick wall teaching to people are coming to these realizations on their own. And I don't think anybody, even people in racing, one of the most common things I'd hear from trainers all the time is how much they love their horses. And I think they really do. And I do think that they get a great level of care, but I liken it to being kidnapped and you're fed really good food.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that makes it mentally better. So no. I think that we're at a stage now where we really have to question what's an acceptable level of wear and tear on a horse's body. Because
hello.
I don't think that the point is to arrive at the grave in pristine condition without having spent some of your body. But what's the reasonable amount of time that we would expect a horse to make that through to? To me, it would be 18 to mid-20s.
At least.
Yeah, at least. You know, usable life where they're still very active and doing, you know, all the things that you want to be doing. And if they're crapping out essentially before then, I think that's premature spending of the body. And so as a society, we have to decide what is an acceptable level of usage on a horse's body? What's an acceptable level of wear and tear?
Mm. And there's often a very, very ingrained cultural and societal pressure there. I've had people turn their noses down at me and my horses because they'd say, oh, low mileage, so of course it's easy for you. And it's like, yeah, but the horses have been with me for the longest time. I haven't contributed towards their arthritis, or the one that's been with me when I got him before the damage really took hold. He's got no arthritis, considering that he's a heavy horse and he lived in hard conditions. He should have, but he didn't, because I got him at the right age.
Yeah.
My Sorrento, who came from Matt Haranetsky, I haven't said this publicly, he's got pretty severe arthritis in his front legs.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's 10. He's 10.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's 10.
Yeah.
He's 10. And he comes to me because he had a reoccurring high suspensory issue. And when I looked at the feet, he had canker in the left front that had been there reoccurring for a couple of winters.
Yeah.
I cured it in 6 weeks.
Wow.
In 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Metronidazole. Got rid of it in 6 weeks. He couldn't bear weight through that foot properly because every time he stepped onto his central sulcus, it hurt.
Wow. Yeah.
You scraped at the canker with your little finger and it bled.
Such delicate structures as well.
This, when you look at his sternum and at his pectorals, his left pectoral was bulging out of his body and his right was sucked back.
Mm.
And this horse was working at a Grand Prix level.
Yeah.
And with top trainers in the industry who have a reputation for being very horse focused.
Yeah. And he was very front heavy, that horse as well, wasn't he?
Well, he's front heavy, but you should see him move now. Yeah. It's just like pouring liquid forward. He's really coming into his body, and his serratus ventralis is opening up, and yeah. I'm working with Celeste on his thoracic sling. But what's really important that we say is that, yes, we should be running, not walking, towards understanding our horse's biomechanics and looking at compensations and releasing their compensations and looking at healthy movement. But some of these diagnoses that these horses are born with, their compensations are holding them together.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
And we should not be decompensating an ECVM horse, because it's the compensation that's stopping the entire body system from utter collapse.
100%. And that's where it becomes an ethical issue, even within rehabilitation. I just last week put down my last rehab horse, my Santa Bred Bourbon that I'd had for 6 years. You know, he came off the racetrack just mentally and physically so
fried.
Absolutely fried. I couldn't rehome him because he was such a talented horse, and I had a connection to him. Bit of a trauma bond, if you will. But I finally had to put him down last week, and I probably waited 6 months too long, to be honest. He could no longer have his feet done, and I found, you know, many internal issues, and it makes me feel a bit shit. But I really struggled with my own horse. You know, he was my last connection to like doing the rehab work. But you know, my Swedish Warmblood that I put down, that had ECVM, you know, he was the first horse that I felt that couldn't, there was just a reason that he couldn't sustain the work. Like, you'd get him to a point and you'd make progress, you'd turn him out for a month, 2 months, and you'd bring him back. It was like starting all over again. And I was like, there's got to be a reason why the work doesn't stick, why he goes backwards physically so quickly. And he had ECVM and then had secondary problems from that as well, you know, like.
Mm-hmm.
He had a dysfunctional lumbosacral junction where one of the nerves comes through in the lumbosacral junction, and the bone had actually spurred into from the lumbar into the sacrum, and that whole area was locked up. And I believe that was just a compensation of what was going on in the front end. And then he had kissing spine because he'd always move in tension. He just physically couldn't let go of the tension, you know, and we had moments where he'd go, ah, and then he'd go, oh, I have to go back there. And I was like, and I'd be like,
what's going on?
I don't feel like this is a miscommunication, because you'd give the aid, he'd give the response, and then he'd suck back. It was like, I'll do it because you're asking me and I understand, but I physically cannot hold that posture for long. And so that was why I really started asking myself questions about whether or not this was ethical. And he did a couple of weird things where he'd hold his tail up really high like an Arab, but he'd only do that when you got out of a walk, and that felt like a compensation as well. So, you know, and this horse wasn't bucking me off. He wasn't rearing. He just was incredibly tense. And yet, for all of the things that I found in his body afterwards, he should have been dumping me.
I see. So this journey for you started very, very personally with a storyline with your own horse.
Yes, it did. Yeah.
Is this right?
Yeah, and I poured money into that horse. I mean, you know, who cares about the money at the end of the day? But, you know, they're bottomless pits of trying to work out, you know, is it feet? Do I need to do something differently with the feet? Is it feed? Is it saddle? You know, there's just so many things. There's so many options these days, which is wonderful. But sometimes none of that matters.
Okay. This is really important that we tell this story, because my horse Caleb is very, very similar. He's 22, came to me when his owner was killed by one of her other horses, and Caleb was attacking everyone. And when you look at his body, I call him a BMW,
okay.
You know. of horses.
Yeah.
Because he's body made wrong.
Yeah.
Body made wrong.
Yeah, right.
He doesn't, like a lot of these thoroughbreds, they look good. You know,
yeah.
Caleb doesn't even, he's got the most beautiful face, but he doesn't even look good. Sway back. He's got like the hind end of a thoroughbred, the front end of a Shetland pony. It's just, it's all a thing. And before I knew what I know now, I thought that through horsemanship, everything was possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that through relationship work and building trust, everything was possible. And I got Caleb in 6 weeks from couldn't touch him, chasing people and attacking people who fed him, to 6 weeks later, I could sit on him, no saddle, no reins, no nothing. And he would just be like, what are you doing up here? I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
He's like, do you want to do something? He's like, okay. And he would just sort of take me around the paddock, just full of grace. And then he would stop and go like this with his face. And bite my leg.
Ooh,
and I was like, that is an ouch.
Yeah.
Now, no disrespect, but people in his life prior to me described him as dominant, described him as a bully, described him as dangerous, described him as difficult, and were frustrated that for 10 years they had built this horse and then got to a point and he wouldn't go any further.
Mm-hmm.
And many, many trainers, including classical and hand trainers, came in and said, well, you know, through classical work, everything is possible. He's just got to learn to be light on the forehand and to carry himself, and everything's possible. This horse, I like, if I could throw all the diagnostics at him, I would, but I can't, because in Spain, you would have to send him to a hospital, and I'm not putting him through that.
Yeah.
I'm not putting him through that. But we discovered like a tumor in his sheath. So anytime he would tuck his pelvis underneath him, he was banging his thigh up against this painful tumor.
Yeah.
So that's why he's trailing his legs out behind. Now, someone would say this horse is being insubordinate, but actually, this horse is full of grace and acceptance and try.
Yeah.
And I think that's the story we need to tell about horses, not the story about bad attitudes, not the story about making fun of them for bucking you off or being cold-backed or describing it as their personality. Horses are full of grace.
100%. And that's one of the reasons why I promoted so hard to humanely euthanize horses, because our Facebook pages in New Zealand are full of teenage girls on a horse thinking it's hilarious while the horse is making a futile attempt to say, I'm in pain, I'm uncomfortable, get off me. And they're like, oh my God, like, oh, he's, you know, and he barks and that's so funny. And they just sit there or they take a photo for Instagram or whatever, you know, casually sitting there as the horse is kicking out, or I can't stomach that. And I won't feed into that. You know, like if a horse is struggling, I don't want to rehome it, because here there's not enough people who are interested in taking the time, building the connection. You know, for a lot of people, horses and the horse human relationship is a hobby, or it's just something that they do in the weekends, or it's an interest. But when you get to an emotional level with a horse, the connection is so much more important than a lot of the stuff that you do with them. You know, like my horses are my friends, you know, and my heart breaks for people who are treating them otherwise. But also, I suppose, you know, horses have been work animals for humans for so long that I think we're in a real transition period at the moment where I think in a lot of ways, the human thought process towards horses, we're in a real juxtaposition at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I try not to be judgmental of people, because I know it's such a journey. And look, I didn't start out with the level of empathy that I have now. It's taken me a long time to build that. And it's taken me a lot of times to get it wrong. You know, when I imported my pre-stallion from Australia, I mean, I thought I was a good rider then. What a joke. And so now I know it's about humility and keeping your ego in check and making sure that you understand that, like, you know, I'm where I'm at now, but I've still got so far to go. And one of the reasons that I love dressage is because it's the pursuit of perfection that you'll never achieve. None of us will.
Mm-hmm.
None of us are getting 100% in, you know, in our dressage. You know, it's the pursuit of perfection, but we're always going to be imperfect. And I don't know, I think there's something really poetic about that, that sort of, you know, striving for that. So that's sort of how I've felt about the journey.
Bex, it's so important that we have people like you who are at the coalface of this industry and this problem, because you're doing what a lot of people couldn't stomach to do, which is take apart their bodies and tell the story of their truth.
Yes, not bone, it's not fun.
By bone. Yeah. It's not fun.
It's not. It's disgusting.
It's disgusting. Yeah. And you've made a decision to put your shoulder into that yoke, and you have my full support and admiration. And if there's anything I can ever do to help you spread that message, see me as a friend. I'm ready to link arms with you and people like you and to move this forwards, because we've got to do better and we must do better.
Yeah.
Because not only for the horses, but for us too. Yes. You know, do we want to be on the right or wrong side of history? And by the way, equestrian sports is more dangerous than motorcycle riding, .. Perhaps because horses aren't serial killers. Horses are potentially dealing with pain and problems that we've either bred into them or trained into them. And if we just stepped back and adjusted a 2% of adjustment in our approach, in our work, be of a huge benefit. We're not talking about necessarily reinventing the entire wheel, because most people have got 95% of everything on point. They just need to let go of maybe 5% of something and say, maybe my horse isn't naughty. Maybe I can just pause right there and stop the ride, and let's consolidate their body, and let's look at a couple of diagnostics. Let's, you know, not push them through it. Let's not bit up. But everything else they're doing might be great. The horse might be accommodated well, fed well, cared for well, trained otherwise in a good manner. And we're not asking people to let go of everything. We're just asking to consider this extra little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And have realistic expectations of what your horse can comfortably do as well. A lot of times when I'm going out and assessing horses for people, I'll, you know, say, okay, well, if it's not coping to jumping a meter 10, are you happy if it's just a happy hacker? And sometimes the answer is no. You know, they're like, no, I want a show jump and I can't keep two horses or whatever. So this horse has to go. You know, some people are just matter of fact about it. Everybody's working with horses for different reasons. And I don't think that we can't ever legislate away people's, you know, decisions. And so that's where it becomes really tricky. So, you know, and everybody's ethics and morals are all different. And like, I mean, you know, I get a lot of pushback about the stuff that I talk about. But I think at the end of the day, you've got to peel back the curtains. Somebody's got to be real talking about this. I don't really... I'm not a vet, so I'm not bound by the rules that vets are bound by. And look, I do work with a lot of vets, and I know that a few of them would like to be more involved, but they're worried about the pushback from their own profession. So the goal for me this year, and I'm working with a couple of people, I've got a wonderful team here of vets and body workers, and we're trying to set up a professional facility in order to operate these dissections from. And I would love to get more vets on board. Like, I really do think a lot of them are missing out seeing all this stuff. And the vets that I do work with, they're like, this is amazing. I just don't understand why more people are not getting on board. But I think at the moment there's a real disconnection, and I wish and I hope and I pray that it will come together, and that they just come to me with an open mind, because I'm not trying to replace them. I'm not trying to be a scientist. I'm not trying to do all these things. You know, when I first started talking about this, there was a lot of people who were very negative, and I was like, oh, just, you know, I don't want to get involved in that. I literally just want to make anatomy interesting to the layperson, so they start thinking about other things that might be happening in their horse's bodies that they haven't thought about, because there's not enough information just freely, you know, given on Facebook. And it's such a wonderful platform to be able to share information with people. And yes, I do sell content on Patreon because I work 7 days a week. And if we work out all the hours, I'm getting pittance, but it's better than nothing. And I changed my entire lifestyle to be able to do this work. I live with my 3 children and my partner in a truck trailer that we converted into a tiny home, so that I could take the financial hit that I was going to take for me to be able to just put my head down and work and release this stuff. You know, I've made huge sacrifices, because otherwise it wouldn't be possible, because how else would you do it? Who would finance this? You know,
no one.
Nobody. So, yeah. Yeah.
You're a hero. That's like, I'm not being facetious. You're a hero for taking this on.
Yes.
Do you know how much of a pioneer you are? in that respect?
Well, I don't feel that I
am. How brave you are?
I don't feel that I am. I just like...
I'm letting you know people will hear your story and hear you talking about the sacrifices you're making for this message. And they will see you as a pioneer and a hero.
It makes me uncomfortable, but
I know. I have a complicated relationship with compliments as well. That's what I tell people when they compliment me. I just say, thank you. I have a complicated relationship with compliments. Yeah. Moving on. Okay.
No, so I'm going to start.
I'm going to start sort of winding down, and I've got these three segments or questions I like to finish with.
Okay.
And we've already been discussing them, but let's summarize them. And the first one is, in the equestrian industry, there is a steaming pile of something in the corner that we need to muck out. Something in the industry that makes you think and say, what the muck? What is that? What is that one thing that you would muck out of the industry?
Oh God, I can't really probably say it in one word, but my answers are always complicated. But I always say to people, a calm horse is a happy horse. I hear too often like, oh, horses love to run, or they love to jump, or like a horse will be running at a fence flat stick. They're like, look how much he loves it. I'm like, he actually looks terrified to me. So a calm horse is a happy horse. And I think that we need to get rid of and muck out this idea that a frantic horse is enjoying its job.
Happy.
Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah.
Very, that's amazing. And you've already been speaking to it, but if you could encapsulate it, there's a tide of change occurring in the equestrian industry right now. We are looking down the throat of more or less a wholesale paradigm shift in the equestrian industry. So how are you in your corner of New Zealand contributing towards that tide of change?
I'm attempting to put out content that is relatable to the average horse person, that piques their interest to want to know more. And everybody's journey to learning is personal to themselves. And I hope that sometimes people will see my videos and it triggers a response in them where they go, I need to know more. Where can I get more information? And they go off and they start their own journey of like self-education, because everybody's journey is so different. And so I hope that I'm inspiring people to just learn a bit more, read a bit more, you know, or follow somebody's program, you know, a bit more closely, or invest in that learning is what I hope I'm inspiring.
Amazing. Amazing. And lastly, what is home for you? All of us are on learning journeys, but many people are on learning journeys that never go anywhere and never come back home somewhere. So around horses specifically, but also in your life, what's home for you? It can be a place, it can be a feeling, it can be an activity, but what's home for you?
Oh, honestly, home for me is just spending time with my horses. Like, one thing that I used to do quite often when I was a kid was just lie out in the paddock with my horses and just be around them. And it really reminds me of why I first got involved with horses. I loved them as an animal. I actually wasn't that interested in the riding that much. The presence of horses is something really beautiful, and they've got so much to teach us. And so home for me is literally just being present with my horses with no expectations and just breathing with them. You know, like you could be standing beside them, and sometimes I'll just do a huge inhale and the horse beside me will just go, and I'm like, yeah, I feel you, buddy.
Yeah.
You know, it's that connectedness that I don't think enough people are just paying attention to, and they're missing out. The horse is missing out. They're missing out. And I feel sad for those people. So home for me is just the presence of horses.
Amazing. I've been saying to a few of my friends lately that I think we were all probably the perfect horse trainers at age 7 through 10.
We all were.
And we spend the rest of our lives trying to come back to that place of innocence and humility and appreciation for the animal.
Yeah.
And awareness of the animal from that childlike humility and awareness of them.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear that. Bex, where can people find you and how can they support your work?
Facebook, I'm quite prolific on Facebook. I do try to post most days. You have to stay in the algorithm of Facebook. It's very unforgiving. I post extra content on Patreon. I post sort of every second to third day. My content is very varied. Sometimes I'll be posting about stuff that I'm seeing for the first time. It's literally a lot of just documentation of what I'm seeing in the horse. And then I will often have to go away and talk to vets and the relative people and do my own research. And quite often I actually don't have answers. I can't find any literature on what I'm looking at. So that does happen often too. But I think I put out a lot of varied content on Facebook and I've committed to doing a training series this year as well. But to be honest, that's being very difficult because I'm dissecting two horses every week at the moment.
Wow. So if anyone out there is interested in taking a closer look at this with a bit of courage, we're going to need a little bit of courage and a good stomach. But if someone's interested in seeing someone who's standing at the coalface of some of the biggest questions and issues that we're faced with in the equestrian industry, and they want to see that through the eyes of a local service provider who's not from the upper echelons of some education hall somewhere, or you know, you are a horse woman who is a professional and who is taking an honest layman's look at this, I highly, highly recommend someone exchanging a small amount of money on Patreon to see and support your work and to engage those ruthless Facebook algorithms and to continue to help this roll forward. So everyone, go ahead and find Bex and support her work. Yes. Well, Bex, thank you so much and wish you a lovely day. Evening. Bye. You've been listening to the Emotional Horsemanship Podcast. I am your host, Lockie Phillips, and that was my guest, Bex Nan. Thank you for joining me, and I hope that you would consider to subscribe to this podcast so that you get first updates of new episodes every single week. You're in the first season of what I hope will be many seasons of a really interesting podcast that takes a deeper look at the horse-human relationship. Thank you for being here, and I'll see you next time.